You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of This, the Parish Council, the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw, and up in Harlem, down on Broadway, it's Terence Dickham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello, old pal.
Hello. Do you know, I know what I want to do with my life now.
You do?
It's all become clear. Yeah, it's taken a long time, yeah. But I know what I want to do. Yeah, I picked up a newspaper. In fact, it was thrust into my hand at Waterloo Station last night, the Evening Standard. And in it featured a piece about Daphne Guinness. And it says, Daphne Guinness, artist and muse. And that's what I want to be, a muse.
Yeah, as opposed to a sort of bombastic modern rock band, but an artist's muse.
Yeah, an artist's muse. It sounds like an absolutely great gig. I wasn't too familiar with Daphne Guinness, so I Wikipedia'd her this morning, and I see that it actually refers, a Wikipedia entry actually calls her inspiration and muse.
Yeah, the professional muse.
So this is a job title.
Yeah, so your job is just to allow an artist to gaze upon you and be inspired.
Yes.
And actually, that's your job. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's in Wikipedia, it says, Daphne Guinness seeks to inspire young women through her intensely cultivated style and elegance. And wait for this. Lady Gaga is among them. Because Lady Gaga said in this interview to the New York Times, Daphne, exceptional human being, woman, icon. Help me look inside myself, examine the lives and personalities in order to understand myself better. Mm. Daphne is a huge source of inspiration for me. I cherish her life.
Well,
imagine that. That's it.
Yeah, well, that just makes me wonder. You know, it's one of these occupations that you've heard of, but you wonder how people get paid for it. And I've always thought this about philosophers. Some bod pops up, on Newsnight or whatever. He's billed as a philosopher. And you think, well, that's great. You know, I'm very admiring of your career as a philosopher. Who pays you? How do you get paid as a philosopher? How does Alan Botton draw his salary? If I set myself up as a freelance philosopher tomorrow, who will be paying me for philosophizing? And the same is true of being an artist muse, isn't it?
Oh Lord! So you think that there's no real profit in this at all?
It's
a sort of lottery role. It's something you do for the community.
It's hard to see who would hold your P45 in your profession as a muse, really. But good luck with it. You know,
I'll give it a go, but it sounds like I may have to try again then. I was really excited about that.
It might pan out, and indeed I might. Might join you in your experiments, and I'll set up as a philosopher, you set up as a muse, see how much money we make.
Yeah, okay, we could compare. In about 6 months' time, we can compare notes.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd be fabulous. Now this week, for reasons that will become clear, I've been pondering the question of the cut-off time for phone calls, Magnus. Listeners, I really want you to take part in this sort of experiment, if you would. Or listeners, you don't actually have to do anything, but I just want you to ponder that question yourselves. I just want you to think about what time is the cut-off time to make a phone call to somebody's private residence.
In the evening.
First of all, why did yesterday was I emailed, I just wanted to quickly email a few friends to see if there's a consensus. And generally, the replies I've got back, the feeling seems to be, don't call early in the morning, nor late at night. But what I did, Magnus, I went to the internet, as one does, for some more answers.
Yeah.
And I came across a website for families families with children, and the website is called The Bump.
Oh, right. So, yeah, okay. As in pregnant.
On this website, The Bump, they've got obviously a forum and threads are in there, people on various topics. But I found one that said, what is your phone call cut-off time? And the first person says, this is somebody called Nikki, says, well, I'm always surprised at this time some people call my house. This morning someone called at 8:30, and I've had calls as late, wait for this, I've had calls as late as 9 to 9:30pm. For me, she says, I wouldn't call someone before 9 a.m. or after 8 p.m. unless that it was an emergency, okay? And it goes on anyway, and there's various people reply to this and say, always call after 8 a.m., not after 7 p.m.
Right, okay.
And it goes on, and there's somebody that said, there was something I wanted to quote from. She says that her sister called her, and she says she was outraged because it was, oh, my God, her sister called her at 9 p.m. And she said, well, you know, I knew it would be a good call because, you know, it's got to be something wrong.
Yeah.
So based on that information, yeah. Meg, sure, what time did you phone me on Wednesday night?
It was 11:29 and 30 seconds, I think.
11:29
yeah.
and 30 seconds. Yeah. What the hell were you thinking?
Well, you see,
it was, in fact, I should just say, so before you ask, I'm going to tell the listeners, this was to tell me something like someone had friended you on Facebook you on Facebook.
It was a little more significant than that. But you might have read in various places that if you're in the vicinity of Mr. Keith Richards, you have to operate on Keith time, which is very slightly different from other people's timekeeping schedule. If you arrange to meet Keith Richards, any time 24 hours, within 24 hours of that appointed time, is acceptable to Keith. So, and Magnus' time runs slightly differently.
So what you're saying, and anybody who knows you has got to be prepared for phone ringing at 11:29 p.m.
That's not late
for a chit-chat.
It's not late to me. That is not late to me. I usually retire at about 1:15, 1:30 in the morning.
Good for you. Good indeed for you. I hope the listeners answered my question in their minds a few minutes ago. And I will guarantee to you, Magnus Shaw, there is not one of them that will.
You're right. I mean, I've already asked this question earlier on today of somebody. And they said if the phone rang at 11:30, the only thing I'd think of is who's died. So
who's dead? That was what I was thinking. I actually said out loud, "Oh my God!"
No, you're absolutely you're right. Clearly, you're right, and I only proffer my humble apologies for rousing you.
It's one of the great social questions, isn't it? Because I always think less impact at getting called at 11:30 at night. I agree, but if you're it's one of those sort of social things, isn't it? If you're invited to someone's house and say they say, come around at 8 o'clock in the evening, what time do you actually arrive? Is it 7:30? Are you supposed to be there at 7:30? Is it 8:30? Are you supposed to be there at 8 o'clock on the dot?
If I say come around at 8, within a minute either side, that is the time I expect to see you. Don't come round at 7:30 if I've said come round at 8, because I will not be ready to receive you. But that's why I said 8, not 7:30. So
this father used to do. He had this absolutely extraordinary fear of being late for anything. So if he had to be somewhere a mile away for 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm not joking, he'd be ready at 6:30 in the morning.
My mum is the same as particularly if she's travelling, she would be ready to leave the house to catch a flight maybe 7 hours ahead of the time she was due at the airport. It's not a bad policy really, because if something does go wrong, you have plenty of time in hand. I'm the opposite. You know, I leave just enough time, and then when things go wrong, I'm in shtuck. So it's not a bad policy, but
I suppose not. But people, I think the generation before us take it to extremes, it seems.
Yeah, they do. Yes, absolutely.
It's all very well being ready maybe 20 minutes early, but 3 or 4 hours.
Oh, I know. But
the reason I mention that is that my father often used to enter into such, when you were saying, if you ask someone to come around at 8, you'd expect them a minute before or a minute after or whatever.
Yeah.
But if my father was asked to go and visit someone at 8 o'clock, he would arrive at 7:30.
Yeah, that's not great, really.
It never changed as well, because he would turn up and he'd always be the first there, and the host or hostess would be a little bit flustered and say, would you mind just sitting in there for we're not quite ready yet, we haven't got dressed yet.
Fine.
It never seemed to occur to him that,
Excellent. Well, I mean, at least he showed the good manners of turning up, you know, ahead of time, if not indeed on time. It's, I think the modern malaise is either to be ludicrously late or to not turn up at all.
Well, to not tell anybody. Yeah, that's a cop. thing as well. The number of meetings that I may attend, and you know, the meeting's due to start at 2 o'clock or something, and at 1:30 you're saying, well, perhaps we better get started because like three of the people haven't arrived and haven't bothered to tell you.
Exactly,
don't get me started on that. Now, I'll tell you what, Magnus Shaw, someone I kind of know, Robert Fox is his name. He works for the Evening Standard.
Oh, yeah.
Something really extraordinary happened to him over the last weekend. I haven't heard of this before. It's a scam that happened to him. And I don't know, maybe I'm a bit behind the times. So I don't know if you've heard of this. And, well, whether you have or you haven't, I mean, you're someone who's way up to speed with these sort of things. You can tell us what you think and give us advice. This is what happened. Robert Fox, defence editor for the Evening Standard, he was at home in London last weekend. But for all intents and purposes, it appeared to the rest of the world that he was in Limassol in Cyprus, and that he'd had his passport, wallet, and other sort of essential things stolen. Mm. What happened was all of his contacts through his Gmail account received an email from him, or as is clear, purporting to be from him, saying, I'm terribly sorry to have to ask you this, but I've had my passport, wallet and everything stolen in Limassol in Cyprus. I haven't got any money to get home. Could you lend me €500 to get me home? And through this, amazingly, lots of his friends, and bearing in mind this is a professional man, he's got contacts all through, well, even in the armed forces. He mentioned that a senior member of the armed forces sent €500 because they give this bank account that you send the €500 to. And, of course, people, hopefully, generally people being kind and pleasant, so many of his colleagues and friends that are on his Gmail address list received this email and stumped up €500 into this account for him to allegedly get back from Limassol when he's still sitting at home in London.
Yeah.
So he began, he somehow got hold and knew it was a scam. And it took him 2 days, by the way, to sort of get in touch with Gmail and fix everything. And in the end, he had to get a contractor. He calls a contractor, I don't know, some sort of an internet contractor, I suppose, to sort of retrace and retrace his steps, if you like, and close this account and inform everybody and change, of course, his passwords to his Gmail account and everything. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I have, and I've not been a victim of it because I didn't fall for it, but I have received those messages. I mean, this one seems to be done particularly well in that it was convincing as to who it was. So that when I've received them, they appear to be from somebody I've never heard of.
Yes, I mean, I've had those, but
saying the same thing, dear friend, could you help me out? I'm stuck abroad, exactly the same premise.
But I think that's different, Magnus, because, I would recognise
they've been recognisable as such. This one seems to be, have been incredibly carefully put together. I have heard of it. And I've heard it reported on various consumer programs as well. It's hard to know what one should do. I suppose if you receive this kind of plea from somebody, and it appears to be from somebody you know, is to just email them back with a question that only they could answer, I suppose. It's like, just for security, could you tell me the name of your cat that I'm feeding for you or whatever? That they'd be feeding your cat. The person's not abroad, but you know what I mean? There's a test question.
He says, by the way, tell me if you think this has got any credibility. He says that, whether it's coincidence or not, but Robert Fox says that last weekend when this happened, he added the Gmail app to his phone and iPad, and it was immediately after that that it happened.
No, that could be entirely related, couldn't it? Yes, absolutely. As it just seems to be, I mean, I'm not a techie, but it would just suggest that there are more platforms for somebody to worm into there, I would have thought, because both those apps will have all your contacts on. So, I think that could have something to do with it. It's a 21st century crime, isn't it? It's like 20 years ago, we wouldn't understand how that kind of thing would be taking place. I guess for every piece of technology that exists and every sort of social structure that exists, there's always somebody waiting to exploit it fraudulently, isn't there? And we have to be on our guard for that. Your friend Robert there, he's obviously quite a smart guy, and they were able to execute it on him because I think one of the reasons is that it doesn't involve the engagement of the person whose account it is. You know, he would have presumably been unaware that this had taken place.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, it's extraordinary as well. You know, anybody might think, oh, well, what divs would stump up €500? But if you think of friends in peril, he says the people that offered the €500 included, and as I say, bear in mind he's the defence editor of the Standard, that they included two army generals, bank managers, ambassadors, interpreters, and friends and colleagues of the Evening Standard and his family.
Well, the fraudster was either very savvy or got very lucky in that he was doing it to people for whom they would have had that kind of money readily available. And, fairly wealthy people who would gladly spare that for somebody. So they got lucky there, didn't they? I mean, presumably the money is not recoverable.
I imagine not, because if you've got any sense, if you're the people running the scam, if they found that it was being run out of Germany, I don't know what significance of that is, but I imagine as soon as that money has gone into that account that's supposed to be in Limassol in Cyprus, you get the money out and close the account.
Yeah, empty is out at the other end, exactly, yes, and they presumably picked up a substantial sum of money, and an hour later picked on another Gmail address and did the same. So, quite alarming. And the only comparable thing I can think of, and this was many moons ago when SMS was quite new, or certainly new to me, text messaging. So what would that be? Yeah. About 2000, something like that. I got a text from a friend that said help, just said the word help. And I looked at it and pondered it and put my phone down again and didn't ignore it, but I just thought, that's odd. And then a few minutes later, another one came that said, help me, please. And then, you know, similar over the space of a few minutes. And
well,
I thought,
spooky.
And I thought, well, you know, it's a friend who lives in London. And I thought, what if he's being held in his house, you know, and he's managed to type out a message to, you know, somebody on his phone, you know, I texted him back and said, you know, what's the problem, and got nothing back. And I said, what do you want me to do, and got nothing back. And then finally I sent a text and said, as you've not replied, I'm going to call the police. And I called the police and said, I'm getting these messages from a friend in London. He appears to be in peril, and I can't get a reply out of him. And I read the four or so messages. And then about an hour later, and I was quite annoyed, to be honest, about an hour later, said, oh, you know, cool your heels, man. It's just somebody messing around on my phone in the pub.
Oh, God.
And he said, but good to know I could rely on you. I thought, well, flip it.
Great.
Yeah, so, I mean, if that had been somebody who had hijacked that identity on the phone, and, you know, the next message was, just send me some money or whatever, you know, I may well have walked into that one, you know. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because essentially, one of the things I find, the older I get, the more I get reassured in life that at the heart, most people are kind.
Yes, that's right.
You know, people
yes.
behave badly at times, but on the whole, most people are kind.
Yes, I think that's true, yes.
And that's what gets exploited.
Yeah, that's what gets exploited. People err on the side of caution, don't they? So this might be a scam, but I would rather be scammed than not help a friend. And unfortunately, if that situation arises for the people who sent the money again with a different friend and it's genuine, they're much less likely to be able to help, aren't they?
I suppose on the opposite side of kindness and human kindness, increasingly I find the ongoing drive of the cheaper newspapers to trying to generate heat from damp Kindle immensely tedious and tiring. I mean, these days it seems the Mail, the Sun and the Star in particular seem to compete to establish who can make a front page splash from the tiniest ripple. And this week, the Daily Mail went bonkers and into overdrive about what it reported was an attack on the Duchess of Cambridge by the author Hilary Mantel. Mm. And out of context, the quotes calling Catherine a machine-made princess designed by committee, a personality-free shop window mannequin with a plastic smile, on the surface, something of a scoop, but there was another tale to tell behind it. So did you grab your copy of the Daily Mail and rejoice over quotes like, this jointed doll on which certain rags are hung to a woman whose only point and purpose is to give birth?
Well, the very notion that I have my own personal copy of the Daily Mail is laughable. But I did see the feature in the online edition. And you say this week the Daily Mail went bonkers. The Daily Mail are bonkers, aren't they? By definition, just week in, week out, the Daily Mail are bonkers. As you say, they... I don't imagine the Daily Mail office to be peopled and staffed by sort of Peter Hitchens clones. They're just lots and lots and lots of Peter Hitchens all getting terribly, terribly perplexed and red-faced about things that don't matter in the slightest, and really sort of running the risk of hernias, you know, in their anger and outrage and opprobrium at things that they perceive to be some slight on the great British nation, you know, that don't really matter to any of us. The first thing I'd say really is I think Hilary Mantel is perfectly entitled to voice any opinion on any matter she so chooses. So I'm absolutely no problem with that at all. But I think the more poignant point to be made is that this had been lifted out of a much larger text, which was actually very sympathetic towards the Duchess of Cambridge. And the point she was trying to make was that Kate Middleton runs the risk of being manipulated by people behind the scenes to be something that they wanted to be rather than the actual person she really is. So it was actually in defence of the real person that Kate Middleton is. And that's the point that Hilary Mantel was trying to make. I suppose you could argue that she walked into a bit of a Daily Mail trap, i.e. that she knew that her comments would reach various ears and that they would be twisted in this way. But really anybody who takes the Daily Mail and some of their compadres at all seriously is doing themselves and everybody else a distinct disservice.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're absolutely right, because the quotes were taken from a lecture that Hilary Mantel gave at the British Museum over 2 weeks ago, and it was organised by the London Review of Books. And as you mentioned, they published her speech in full, and I imagine someone at the Daily Mail just sort of cottoned on to the fact that this speech was there. And when you read the transcript, and I've read the whole piece actually, because it's extremely well written, and as you allude to it, it looks at the contrasts of royal figures through the ages, incorporating such diverse figures as Marie Antoinette and Anne Boleyn, and the comments about Duchess of Cambridge, Catherine Middleton, were actually in the context of how the press today portrays the royal family, in contrast with the perception of contemporary observers of royalty in the past.
And did you notice that the honourable gentleman, the fine upstanding David Cameron, our proud Prime Minister, has really started to become a bit of a renter quote, hasn't he? There's nothing that fellow won't comment on. you could ask David Cameron to comment on, somebody who'd said that Jack Russells are a lesser breed of dog than Afghan hounds, and he'd give you, 3 or 4 minutes on the subject, wouldn't he?
Well, I see what you mean, but to be fair to the fellow, he was on a trip to India, so he wasn't in the country, so he's, you know, not in minute-to-minute touch with the rolling news. And so the press pack come up to him and just try and grab a quote as he passes through a mixed zone, as they call it. And so if somebody shouted out to him, Prime Minister, the writer Hilary Mantel has said... And then, you know, the quotes we said earlier, plastic person.
Sure.
Under the spotlight and with microphones thrust in his face, he's going to say things like, oh, that sounds like a hurtful thing to say.
Yeah, well, this is where he's a fool, because he knows how the press works. He doesn't have the background briefing
He hasn't read the Hilary Mantel piece. He probably hasn't read the Daily Mail piece. The sensible and strategic approach would be to say, I'm afraid I haven't seen either of those, but it does sound like an interesting issue. And, you know, I'll make sure I'm across it when I get a chance. What's wrong with that?
Nothing's wrong with that, but I think all politicians are fearful of being seen as not up to speed with things, and therefore out of touch. Because although the way you describe it there would be a very fair way of saying things, the next day I suspect the Guardian and the Daily Mirror would be all over Cameron out of touch. You know, and comparing him to somebody like Harold Macmillan in 1959 saying, you know, have you got anything to say on the great crisis, Prime Minister? No, nothing to say at all.
Well, you know, there's something in that, actually. There's something a bit more desirable than just, you know, firing off renter quotes. I think he got drawn into it like an absolute fool and revealed himself to be exactly what he lived in fear of, is that it's being poorly briefed on the subject. And I do think, I wouldn't go quite as far as the Harold Macmillan situation where he had no comment to make on anything, but to say, you know, in a tactful way, this is sort of not my priority right now, is fair comments. And I think, yeah, the next day's reaction will be what it will be, but I think the accumulative image you give then is of somebody who is fair-minded and doesn't know everything about everything. And
my point is, it wouldn't be reported that way. What you're saying is perfectly reasonable, but the next day it would be, Cameron refuses to back Duchess.
I think you can say, I can't really give you a detailed comment because I'm not aware of the two pieces that you refer to, but if Kate has been unfairly treated, I would be the first to defend her. Something like that, you know.
And you think the Daily Mirror would actually report that quote in full?
But my point is that if you are existing as the leader of a country in thrall to what one newspaper may say the following day, then you've lost your credibility and your dignity, really.
I think the answer is that it's just simply so tedious to still be in the age of these tabloid dinosaurs who do themselves no favours in their, by the, you know, remembering their desire, that indeed their quest for self-regulation with these absurd, blurred versions of what they think is reality, and it's to suit their agenda.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And self-regulation is a posh term for leave us alone to get on with whatever we want to do. That's what self-regulation means. It is a cry to be, indeed, an aggressive attempt to be left alone to do absolutely anything they want. And self-regulation is a deferment of regulation. So we don't want any regulation. It's very similar to when the Princess of Wales died. The editors and staff of so many of these papers came forward to say under no circumstances would they have any truck with paparazzi photography anymore, because of course it was perceived to have caused the death at the time. And made pledges to their readers and to the country that from now on things were going to be utterly, completely different, and there would be no pursuit of famous people in this way anymore. And of course, it probably took about 3 weeks before that's, you know, exactly what they went back to, is to the default behaviour. And this is the same thing, really. It's post Leveson, all sorts of grand statements have been given and lofty promises, and what evidence have we got that that the tabloid press want to change in any shape, way or form? They don't. They want to be left to get back to what they've always done.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's particularly chilling as well, because in the sense that, I mean, I may be over-dramatising it here, but considering that, you know, it's a bit of a consensus that the Princess of Wales's car back in... What was the year? 1997. When she was going through that tunnel, was being pursued by paparazzi photographers on scooters. Mm. And so naturally, William and Harry, it's still very much at the front of their thoughts, as that's what in a sense, killed their mother. And for William to see the same sort of treatment being handed out to his wife on a just purely personal level, doesn't matter if the royal connection or whatever, just as human beings, I just think it's a despicable way to be carrying on.
I think it's despicable, and I think it's hypocritical as well. I couldn't help notice, certainly on the Daily Mail website where I read this piece, that there was a sort of sidebar which said, you know, the Hilary Mantel story or whatever, and it was just some bullet points about Hilary Mantel. And one of the top one was all fair enough. Hilary is a award-winning author of Wolf Hall and da-da-da-da-da. So it's fairly factual stuff. And then the remaining three or four bullets were about how, since a severe case of endometriosis, forgive my medical pronunciation there, she's gained more than 4 stone and now carries an unhealthy amount of weight, and and she's said publicly how she sometimes dreams of being the thin woman she used to be. And this is all to suggest that she has some seething jealousy of Kate Middleton being young and slim, which is completely manufactured. I don't believe she dislikes Kate Middleton because she's thin and slim. I don't believe she dislikes her at all. And to suggest, oh, look, it's an unattractive, fat, middle-aged woman having a go at a beautiful princess. You know, how laughable. Yes. Is revolting. It's disgusting. And actually, completely, impertinent and irrelevant, because it's not a situation that exists.
Absolutely so. Also, very much in the news in the latter part of the week, around the same sort of time as the Mantel story, was a collapse of a well-publicised trial on Wednesday. The jurors in the trial of Vicky Price, the ex-wife of the former cabinet minister, Mr. Hoon, the jurors were discharged on Wednesday after the judge said that it was highly unlikely that they would reach a verdict in her case. And there are 8 men and 4 women on this jury. And this all came about because they handed a list, after being in discussion about whether, you know, guilty, not guilty, whatever, they handed the judge a list of 10 questions, which he said gave him concerns of, quote, that of their absolutely fundamental deficits in understanding.
Yeah, now, he did. Yes, yeah. This is a delicious story. This is my favourite story from the week. This is
okay. Yeah.
Simply because it comes over like a rather well written and well conceived comedy sketch. This notion of the grand rolling out of British justice and all the paraphernalia and detail and sophistication that goes with modern day trial, all completely undermined by a jury who don't know various parts of their anatomy from other parts of their anatomy.
Can you define what is reasonable doubt? Can you define what is reasonable doubt? And the Mr. Justice Sweeney's reply was, a reasonable doubt is a doubt which is reasonable.
Yes, it's the exasperation of the judge which really got me tittering. Of course, it's not on the face of a funny situation, certainly not for the judge, and certainly not for the public purse, which has got to now fund another trial. But just
or for indeed for Miss Price.
Well, no, it's got to go through another trial. No, I agree. Of course, there are aspects of this which are far from amusing, but just taken as a broad brushstroke, it is quite funny, and it's really begs to be written up as a comedy sketch, doesn't it, really? I mean, it's beyond it's beyond what you could make up, to be honest. I love this notion of a jury who haven't the faintest idea what they've been involved in and what they're supposed to do now is somehow just highly, highly ticklesome, I think.
Yes, I think you're right, and it sort of does give the rise to more general questions. I mean, we'll come back to one or two of the questions they asked me.
Yeah, they're great.
Whether we should reconsider trial by jury in certain cases in this country, or also another question is, should people have to undergo some form of intelligence test before they can become jurors. Because we've had this issue, gosh, way back to Anglo-Saxon times. I think it was when the Vikings came over. They loved to be in court and take people to court and question people. And it was back from then. I think it's back from sort of Danish law that 12. You know, good men, 12 principal men were formed into some sort of committee to decide whether, you know, this was your land or his land.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, whether you took his, one of his sheep or you didn't.
Yes.
And, I think it was from that that we cottoned onto this jury system right through to, the Magna Carta, which of course was signed only a couple of miles from where I live.
Ooh,
at
the
historic Reading.
Right through to this week, seemingly.
Indeed so. Before we just go back to Miss Price and these questions, I noticed in the BBC report of the collapse of the trial, which, as we say, we do understand does have very serious aspects to it.
It does.
But... The BBC reported that in 1993, they were looking back at other times the jury system's been, you know, sort of called into question. And in 1993, a very serious charge, a man was jailed for life for murdering a couple in East Sussex. But on appeal, the defendant's conviction was thrown out after it emerged that four jurors had consulted an Ouija board to contact dead people.
Oh, no.
Absolutely. I mean, it should be said he was convicted again after a retrial.
Yeah.
But the first consideration was thrown out. Four out of the 12 had gone to an Ouija board to try and contact the two dead people.
Well, that's astonishing that nobody, the remainder of the jury, the other eight members of the jury, didn't go to the judge and say, I should just let you know, da 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 da. I mean, perhaps they did, I don't know, but...
Maybe that's how
it happened. Yeah, yeah.
This is one of the questions that the Vicky Price jury gave to the judge. Would religious conviction be a good enough reason for a wife feeling she had no choice to obey?
Yes, I know, yes. And I think one of the questions was... is it acceptable to base our decision on facts which haven't been brought up in court and for which we have no evidence? Was that, that was one of the questions?
It is indeed.
No.
Exactly. The judge said, no, you have to decide the case on the evidence.
Yes,
and
incredible.
There was one about, can we speculate about the events at the time that she signed the form or what was in her mind at that time? And again, Justice Sweeney said the answer to that is an equally firm no.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah, it's quite astonishing. And I'm sure it will go down in the annals of legal history, won't it? An example of a failed jury. But
I think it will. But who's to say that the next 12 people that troop through Southwark Crown Court next week, because I think it's being rerun next week.
From Monday.
Will be any brighter or more aware of just the most basic concepts.
Well, this is right.
Human justice.
I think the serious issue you raise is it time to put barriers in the way of serving on juries? I don't think we can do that. I think everybody can see that there is an inherent fairness in being brought before 12 of your peers. Not 12 academics, not 12 policemen, not 12 judges, and not 12 barristers, but 12 people just like you and me, in inverted commas. And I think there is an inherent fairness in that we'll be sorely sorry to lose in any kind of legal system. And I think it would throw up so many chances for appeals and legal questions if you said, well, I wasn't tried fairly because you picked these people based on X, Y, Z, going to Oxbridge or whatever. But it does make me wonder whether in the jury room there should not be an objective officer who is not there to guide you to your verdict, but is there to guide you through the process and to step in and say, no, you can't go down that route. You know, it's got to be based on this. Or in answer to the question that you have, I can confirm it. I wonder if there shouldn't be a sort of mentor for the jury who can keep them focused on the matter in hand and to clarify
the purpose of their existence.
This is a bit like Leveson with the press, though, isn't it? Because who would appoint this mentor, this
They'd be a public servant and an employee of the court, I guess. And like I say, it wouldn't be their job to suggest, I mean, quite the opposite. It wouldn't be their task to suggest where the jury should take their verdict to, but just there to marshal the process. I think that these problems often arise because they are cloistered away, these 12 people. A chairman is appointed and then it's up to them. And I wonder if, you know, more often than not, or certainly more often than we ever hear about, they drift way off the beaten track in the process. And this is clearly what's happened here. The only reason we know that they'd lost their plot. Certainly become wayward. Yes, was because they posted these 10 questions to the judge. Had they not done that and had come back with a verdict, we would never know that they were reaching their conclusion in a completely inappropriate way. If there was, you know, a sober, intelligent, and well-briefed officer of the court in there with them to marshal their process, it would prevent that happening. So I think there might be something in that.
There might be. I mean, it's hard for us because we haven't been in court, but on the surface, it does seem that this particular case, which of course we are obviously not going to talk about in any detail, but in terms of deciding yes or no, it seems a relatively simple case. But what I'm worrying about, I suppose, is some cases that come up before juries, and I mean, we must still remember that the bare minimum of cases that actually go to jury. Most, I think it's around something like 90%, maybe even 95% of cases in this country actually are decided by magistrates, magistrates or whatever. So it is a very small number of cases that go to jury. However, I'm sure I've come across cases before where a case will go on for month after month after month, and it can be a very long, complex case. And I'm thinking particularly if it's, for example, some alleged criminal behaviour in the money markets or something to do with finance, which, you know, can be an extremely complicated position. Now, I don't think and I suspect you may feel the same, would automatically feel comfortable and at ease at making a decision about very, very complex financial matters going across, and a case that lasted months and months. So I'm not sure whether your man, your mentor in the jury room would help. I don't know. I just don't know. But what I do, I must stress, I don't want to see the end of juries myself, because that's how you end up having the state.
Yes,
deciding.
You end up with a star chamber.
Exactly.
Yes, and I agree. And yeah, it's always going to be an imperfect system. I mean, the human frailty guarantees that justice is a fragile process. But surely a jury of your peers has got to be preferable to almost any other system. And we just need to find ways to try and put a finer point on it as possible, really.
Yeah, yeah. And whether, last point on it is, I wonder whether after the decision has been given, whether juries, rather like so much else in life now, should be under the gaze of CCTV and recorded, audio and visual, in the jury room, so that perhaps, whether there would be some trouble with this, I don't know, but so that both the prosecution and the defence could review how the jury came to their decision, which may help in terms of whether an appeal is necessary or not.
Yes, perhaps the judge should have sole access to that. Otherwise, the prosecution and defence would always, the losing side would request the CCTV and kick up a stink.
Yeah.
But I think it's important the judge has confidence that the verdict has been reached in an even-handed way. It does seem
very archaic now that we can only see court cases as charcoal drawings on pieces of paper. It does yes. seem to be a bit last yeah. century. And so, yeah, you might have something there as well. But I mean, we are lay people. We don't have huge insight into the law, but certainly in this case, something rather troubling and equally hilarious went adrift, didn't it?
It certainly yeah. did. For our, moving on to a completely different subject, for our television review this week, we were given a Channel 4 documentary which aired on Tuesday at 10 o'clock PM, The Fried Chicken Shop, Life in a Day. And this looked at Rooster's Spot was the actual fried chicken shop on Clapham High Street. And a relatively new process in filming fly-on-the-wall documentaries in that most of it was filmed by a rig of fixed cameras in the shop. So there wasn't the intrusion of people having to overcome the presence of cameramen actually in the shop. Mm. So anyway, Rooster Spot is a new breed of chicken shop franchises. We saw manager Ali and his team of six helpers. And we saw a lot of interaction between the customers and staff and customers. And it seemed to be something of a social centre for the local people. I only took one quote from a customer who said, "I don't want no salad," which is what he said when he served his chicken. It's all about chicken in there. I what cheered me was every ethnic background was represented yeah. in Rooster's Spot, every age group. And it supported my theory that there's no real racial issue with young people, because groups of youngsters, school kids, college kids, it was delightful to see, because we just saw friends of every shade and background chatting and laughing yes. together. Yeah. Just one thing before I ask you what you felt, the most extraordinary thing, I don't know, I kind of loved this moment, but in a kind of bad taste way. This man came in and he gave another customer his business card.
Yes.
And his business was delivering what he called Charlie, an MDMA. Is Charlie cocaine?
Yes, it is, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but the bonus feature of his delivery service was that it was 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
So if ever you were in the need of his products, yeah. you know, he was just a phone call away. Yeah, yeah, the fried chicken shop on Clapham High Street, Magnus.
Well, I used to live just around the corner from where this place is set up, actually. So I'm familiar with the neighbourhood. And it's a fantastic neighbourhood for the reasons you've described, actually. You've got Clapham Old Town, which is a bit posher just down the road, and Clapham Common, which is a bit more down at heel, and Clapham High Street, which is where this chicken shop is. And you're right, it is it's really exciting, interesting, vibrant community where, on the whole, everybody rubs together really well. It made me think that the sort of rather overblown campaign against convenience food outlets on the high street has really had some of the winds taken out of its sails now, because, as you said, this had rapidly become a little community centre. Most of the people sat in there eating were talking to the other strangers in there sitting in there eating. They weren't people they knew, but they were having this shared experience over fried chicken, which sounds funny, but actually something quite moving and quite profound was taking place, wasn't it? That it was just a few minutes in the day where you could exchange some pleasantries with somebody who had a very trivial but nevertheless a very real common interest, which was having something to eat. And I thought the guys behind the counter were probably sort of prime movers in this, because their attitude to the people who came in was very respectful and very laid back and informal. And I think there's obviously a good atmosphere in the place. The fact that they were eating incredibly calorific, greasy yeah. chicken is perhaps for the medics to answer. But in terms of a public service, it was a great public service. I enjoyed the programme. I mean, and as you say, the fact that, I mean, clearly everybody had to sign releases and some people hadn't, so their faces were obscured, but most people had. But they were being filmed by unobtrusive cameras, so you didn't get the interference or the influence of a sound boom and a shoulder-mounted camera, as you often get in fly-on-the-wall stuff. It was all done very surreptitiously, which you could tell because everybody was completely relaxed and completely themselves. My only criticism, and it was interesting, and I really enjoyed seeing
who came in and what they did when they were in the shop. And clearly they edited the... lots of people who come in who did very little, but they edited it so we saw the most interesting people, as you would. But they were interesting people, they were very real people. And you felt, you knew them as well. You certainly felt like you were sitting in the chicken shop, didn't you? My only caveat was that about 40 odd minutes into it, I'd seen enough. The last 15 minutes, it just pulled a bit for me. It was just clearly nothing more dramatic was going to happen, and I'd kind of had I'd had my fill of the fried chicken shop after about 45 minutes. But that didn't mean it wasn't a very enjoyable 45 minutes.
Isn't it interesting the number of times that you and I review an hour long show that one of us says that it would have been better at 30 or 40 or 45 minutes. It's interesting. The only time that I felt I wouldn't have been at ease in Rooster's Spot, was at by 10 past 2 in the morning, when they were still open, the customers were not really people I would want to socialise with.
No.
But they stay open till 6 o'clock a.m. at the weekend.
And this is the American model, isn't it? This is any kind of food that you think you might require at sort of 3:47 in the morning in America, you know, it's just a quick car trip away, isn't it? They're all there all night.
Well, that would suit you, wouldn't it, Mr. 11:30 telephone call man?
Well, quite, but,
I liked Ali, the manager at Rooster's Spot, because he gave free food to people who couldn't afford to pay, and I thought that was really quite touching. Many would do that. I have to say, I loved this programme. For me, the hour flew by. It flew by like a chicken trying to escape from a deep pan
fryer.
It flew
like a chicken can't, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I really loved it, and I heartily recommend it. Yeah. And I hope they go back again sometime in the future to see how some of those characters are getting on.
Yeah, and I think Ali has done a sterling job of turning... a fast turnaround business into something much more significant for his community. I would just add the dedication of, now you'll probably jot this down, which is in your nature, but the younger staff member who we saw a lot of.
Wackar.
Yeah,
Wackar. W-A-Q-A-R. Wackar.
Thank you, Wackar. Travelled an hour and a half there and an hour and a half back to work in this chicken shop. And, all respect to him. It was a tough job. He probably isn't paid enough. Paid terribly much for that particular job, because it's a small business. But he believed in what he was doing, and his boss believed in what they were doing, and they conjured something much more significant out of something which was essentially just a fast food shop. Great, really good.
Wackar came across as a really kindly young man who missed his mum back in Pakistan.
Yes, and, absolutely. Yeah.
So this was The Fried Chicken Shop, Life in a Day on Channel 4. It was narrated by, of all people, Roots Maneuver.
Yes.
And, directed and produced by Yoni Yusiskin, Mental Media Production for Channel 4. Recommend it if you want to find it on 4OD. Yeah.
Well, we've dipped into the BBC4 reruns of Top of the Pops in the past, I know, but we thought it was high time we took another look, especially as they're now into 1978, and we also thought we'd get a fresh perspective from our correspondent, Rona Martin, who watched the show this week. Hello, Rona.
Hello, Magnus.
Hi. So, which superstar DJ was fronting the show with his charisma and infinite skill on Thursday night?
It was David Kidd Jensen.
Oh, really? Brilliant. And was he still a kid?
He was a slip of the lad.
Absolutely. So anyway, we had David Kidd Jensen, and who was he presenting to us? Which top pop acts?
Oh, the pop acts we had last night were, the Tom Robinson Band, looking every bit like the Grange Hill After School Club.
I think we always think that there must have been a period of Top of the Pops where, every episode was ram-packed full of Elvis Costello, Sham 69, Blondie, the Buzzcocks, but it was never like that, was it?
It was never wall-to-wall cool, was it? It was always, something, one really good thing, it seems, dropped in, cheek by jowl with beige and puce trouser suit.
So who was the most uncool act that we had on Thursday? Thursday night then.
What about the darts? Who seemed to be on every week, didn't they?
Through the 70s, I think it was compulsory that the darts were on top of the pops.
Dan Hegarty, indescribable. Really? Sort of top three scary people from Top of the Pops. Who else did we have? Right, we had Kate Bush, the wonderful Kate Bush, having her debut on Top of the Pop. I don't know if that was her TV debut or not, but yeah, I think it was her debut on Top of the Pops. And my God, what an amazing woman. I mean, I remember, you know, that episode of Top of the Pops, and, you know, as a little girl, what was I, maybe about 7 back then? Yeah, it would have been about 7. We were all talking about her in the playground the next day, and my mum and dad were talking about her. And, you know, my mum and dad weren't particularly groovy or anything, you know. You know, they were quite happy listening to the Jim Reeves records. But it was, wow. I mean, my dad probably fancied her, but, you know, she was beautiful, but she was so talented and so original.
So was she dancing? Was she?
Well, she was doing her usual kind of, I don't know, how would you describe it?
Ethereal floating.
Yes, that would be it, that she became quite famous for. Just a beautifully graceful lady.
All right, so we had Kate Bush, we had darts, and the terrifying Dan Hegarty, Tom Robinson. Who else?
Billy Joel, sweating over his piano, singing "Just the Way You Are."
Now, was this beamed in from the United States, or was?
It was concert footage. There's, you know, for such a mellow song, there's no other way he should be sweating so profusely.
Not a nice image. I mean, you know, he's not dashingly handsome, is he? And
no, I mean, it maybe looked like he just stepped out the boxing ring, chucked on a white suit and sat in front of the piano.
Exactly, but just add a sheen of sweat to that. That's not an image I really need in my head at all, really. But and he was and he was doing "Just the Way You Are." Right. Well, that, I mean, that has lasted as a song, hasn't it?
Yeah, totally a wedding dance favourite.
And of course, the ubiquitous Legs and Co would have been there.
Oh, the splendid Legs and Co. This week, the BBC wardrobe department excelled themselves. They'd been doing the markets and got a bargain bundle of net curtains to adorn the lovely ladies. I remember, you know, being that age and thinking they were truly wonderful, though.
Did you aspire to be a Legs and Co?
Possibly.
I'm prying now, but bear with me. Did you, behind the locked door of your bedroom, put on a record and pretend to be Patty or Babs?
No, I didn't actually. It was ABBA we used to flounce around. And
you aspired to be Agnetha or Anna Frida?
Well, I had to be Frida because I did not care.
Because you were dark?
Yeah.
Yes. So who was your Agnetha? Did you have a blonde mate?
Oh, yeah, one of my pals. She had blonde hair, so.
So it's 1978. One thing is absolutely guaranteed, that, well, our Swedish friends who we just spoke about are surely going to be on Top of the Pops. Did we get some ABBA?
Oh, we were lucky enough to have the classic Take a Chance on you.
The split screen,
yeah,
four camera.
Yeah, the video. It's wonderful.
I suppose quite an innovative video for the time, wasn't it?
Yeah. Although this time, I've never paid so much attention to it before. There's something a tad menacing about Frida in this video. She keeps winking at the camera and, you know, very, very alluring. Her dancing leaves something to be desired.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a 70s Top of the Pops without a bit of ABBA there. Well, Rona, thank you very much for watching Top of the Pops 1978 for us on Thursday. Look forward to hearing from you again on a future podcast. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Everybody's on.
Time then, Magna Shaw, to turn our attention to the pretend iPod. This is where we select a track. We're over 100 tracks now on our pretend iPod, where we select a track that is meaningful to us, and we explain why, and it goes on to our pretend iPod on the Rocking Vicar website, and you can listen to any, all, or any combination of the what will be 102 tracks after today, and also on Spotify, where you can also either play songs at random, pick whatever you want, ditch the ones you don't like, on the Spotify playlist under the umbrella title of my colleague here, Magnus Shaw. Yeah. That's for new listeners. New listeners start here. They always used to say that when I was little, my mother's weekly magazines used to feature stories, and it used to say new readers start here.
Yes, yeah. I recall that. Yes,
yeah. Record producers, or at least successful ones, I suppose I should say, seem to hit a hot streak where every project they touch turns to platinum. George Martin, Phil Spector in the 60s, later Mickey Most, Shel Talmy, Glyn John, Steve Lillywhite, I suppose more latterly Timbaland, Dr. Dre, Mark Ronson. One of the hottest of hot streaks was blazed by Trevor Horn in the 1980s, producing massive hits for Pet Shop Boys, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Grace Jones, Band-Aid, Simple Minds, and the group I'm featuring this week, ABC. It was the first work from the production team that Trevor Horn gathered, and that would go on and create all those hits. All of that team contributed significantly to the success of ABC's first album, The Lexicon of Love. Now, when he was in the public eye in those days, Trevor Horn favoured, even when playing with the sort of prog rock group Yes, he wore sharp business suits and these over-large glasses. and they didn't appear much older than his years. I was really quite amazed to look back and realise he was only 32 when he was producing The Lexicon of Love. He looked at least 15, 20 years older. I hope he forgives me for saying that. Trevor Horn, CBE, he's an outstanding producer of hits. He creates this really clean sound and lots of space with room for hooks and innovation. Unfairly, I think, he's been called an everything but the kitchen sink producer. And he does a lot of effects, but sparingly and spread over an album rather than jamming all of his tricks into a single track. So talking about that team, equal credit to everybody on the Lexicon of Love. It should go from ABC themselves. Credit should go to the wonderful orchestration scores by Ann Dudley and the then innovative programming of the Fairlight CMI sampler. This was one of its first outings by Jonathan Cicalic. And, of course, the Fairlight CMI sampler, if you don't know what I'm talking about, just look it up. You'll see that it really swam through the 80s and the early 90s as a sort of a sampling process, in the early days of sampling. The Lexicon of Love is one of those very rare albums. There's really not many with no filler. I've been playing it almost non-stop this week. Every single track is a zinger, and it's a result of those sort of production sensibilities becoming matched with a group, ABC, who had just constructed a set of outstanding pop songs. So I could have picked almost any from this aptly named lexicon of a moment in pop history. I had to disregard The Look of Love because it's forever tainted by the memory of Paul Morley shoehorning his way into a Top of the Pops appearance with ABC back in the 80s. So I had to disregard that. So I've chosen All of My Heart, one of the four tracks released as a single, and like on most of the tracks on the album, Martin Fry sings about falling in love and losing that love, skip the hearts and flowers, skip the ivory towers. ABC's All of My Heart fits perfectly into Martin Fry's vocal range, probably his best performance on the album, swoony, dreamy orchestration and arrangement, and Trevor Horn, he's also an expert mixer. Many producers aren't. Todd Rundgren is a great producer. He's not a good mixer. Trevor Horn is both. So it's got this passionate, dramatic chorus. Now that you've gone, I still want you back. The strings arrive, and they're so ageless that they would have made Ivor Novello cry. From August 1982, reaching number 5 in the UK Top 40, 5 minutes, 12 seconds, ABC, All of My Heart.
Well, I don't know about Ivor Novello. This almost makes me cry. It's such a wonderful track from such an absolutely heartbreakingly brilliant album that really I would hesitate to add anything to what you've just said. The fact is, this is pretty close to pop perfection and will remain so for millennia. absolutely, what an album and what a track off it. So good pick, good pick. It would have only been a matter of time before I would have chosen this, and you've trumped me, but that is okay, because it is now on the Pretend iPod as an absolute sterling piece of work. Now, some singles you can't even imagine being released today, let alone making the top 10. A perfect example of this, and we're all about the 80s this week, would be Ghosts by Japan. Taken from the 1981 album Tin Drum. Oddly enough, when you regard the album's title, no drumming on there. Although there's plenty on the album, but not on this particular track. In fact, it's not particularly representative of the Japan sound. It stands alone, really. But none the worse for that. All you really have is this mournful synthesizer sound, some plucked strings, a xylophone. I mean, you don't always get a xylophone in a pop record. And of course, most importantly, David Sylvian's plaintive, highly distinctive vocals. I remember at the time people were saying, he's a bit like Brian Ferry, but he is a bit like Brian Ferry, coincidentally, but really, always unmistakably David Sylvian, singing that in that very sort of feminine and sculpted way. But if you haven't heard David Sylvian singing, just listen to it. It will describe itself better than I ever could. But this comes really markedly, I think, from a time when the more idiosyncratic a band style and sound, the more attractive they seem to be, which is certainly not the current fashion, is it? I think the current fashion is for all bands to ape a sound that already exists as closely as possible in order to sell to as many units to as many people. But I don't think we realised it in the early 80s, but we were living through a time where people were trying to be attractive by being completely different from everybody else. And Japan was certainly that. I can't think of a band that you could say, oh, they're a bit like Japan. Because, like I say, it was a time where Frankie Goes to Hollywood were all conquering, but they didn't sound like anybody else. And Japan was supremely successful, but they didn't sound like Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Spandau Ballet didn't sound like either of those two, but they were successful as well. You see the point I'm trying to make. Like I say, from a time where idiosyncratic style and sound really made all the difference, this is a completely unique and rather moving song, I think, actually. You play it at the right time of night, in the right frame of mind, with the right memories running through your head, and you'll get quite choked up at this. It's not a cheery record, but then some of the greatest records that we know of are far from cheery. Made number 5 on the UK singles chart in 1982. I cannot imagine a record that sounds like this coming anywhere close to that kind of pinnacle in the current era, which perhaps says something about the state of pop music. Unfortunately, David Sylvian found this profile, this huge success, so counter to the hopes and ambitions he had for himself and the band that he broke the band up a couple of months later. Wow. That was a brave move, but obviously one he felt sincerely was what he needed to do. Much to the chagrin of his label and his management, who were furious. But it's his prerogative. But unfortunately, what I think happened is that what he did, and he was perfectly entitled to do it, he robbed us of more work from what would probably have gone on to be one of the most intriguing and creative acts of that era. I would love to have heard what Japan would have done in the late 80s and mid to late 80s. But there you go, 1982, and they were gone. Still, they did do this, and it's my pick of the week. Japan from 1982, their final and most successful single, Ghosts.
It's a wonderful, wonderful track, and I think if the rumours are to be believed, one of the reasons that the band broke up at that specific moment was that David Sylvian was also borrowing the partner of another member of the band, and that caused
yes,
a great
deal of... this is not unique, is it? To wit, Fleetwood
no.
Mac, but a shame that it all came crashing down quite so quickly. I mean, the Tin Drum was their huge album, wasn't it? But there's 3-4 previous albums from Japan. Gentlemen Take Polaroids was the one before, and that is utterly fantastic as well. And there's a live album called Oil on Canvas, which I can heartily recommend too. If you only know a little bit about Japan or nothing at all, there's a mission for you this weekend. Get yourself immersed in some Japan. They were a remarkable act.
Couldn't agree with
you. Yeah, absolutely. Intriguing, I think, is the adjective I've applied to Japan, because as I say, they're not like any other band of the time or any band since. So well worth a...
Everything that David Sylvian has ever done, I may be surprising to some. Everything he's ever recorded, I own it. I absolutely adore his work. Everything that he's done with Japan, his solo work, Nine Horses, Rain Tree Crow, and his collaborations with people like Robert Fripp and others, I have them all. And I just adore David Sylvian in particular and much of the work of Japan. Mm. And, of course, David... Mick Kahn's no longer with us.
No, I was going to say that. He died last year, didn't he, I think?
Yeah, cancer, of course. Yeah. That bloody thing that takes so many away from
us. It does.
This in particular is a wonderful track. It's so sparse, as you say. And again, as you quite rightly point out, we'd not even probably have a chance of being released today, never mind making it into the top five. But absolutely splendid work. He's got a wonderful voice. I think those early criticisms that, oh, he's trying to look like Bowie and sound like Ferry.
Yeah.
Well, you know, okay, maybe, you know, he was influenced by the sort of glam rock era. But nonetheless, they carved out their own wonderful path, and as I say, I have everything that he's ever recorded,
right,
and listened to it most regularly.
Well, I can't claim the same. I'm not a David Sylvian completist like you, but I certainly share your sentiments about him as an artist. Yeah, fantastic stuff. Interestingly enough, around this time, these were my nightclubbing days, the early 80s, and I used to go to a club in Nottingham where many, many fellows would turn up trying to look as much like David Sylvian as they possibly could, and they were trying to out-Sylvian each other, and some looked, you know, uncannily like Sylvian. Some were maybe carrying a bit more weight or a bit more spotty, or, you know, just didn't look like him at all, and the end result was a little less endearing. But imagine that in a nightclub full of people trying to look like one particular guy.
Well, you look at the two tracks we've chosen this week, and the two we've got the two singers there, David Sylvian and Martin Fry. In 1982, the sort of era we're talking about here, if you put them side by side, there wouldn't be a huge amount in difference from them in their look. They sort of crossed paths at that particular stages of their career, and both kind of influenced by the kind of glam rock David Bowie Roxy Music era.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're not that far apart.
They both loved the fringe, didn't they?
They really like to wear that fringe.
A sweeping fringe.
Fringe.
Yeah.
Sweeping fringe.
Yeah. Well, great pick from you, and I hope everybody enjoys my pick. David Sylvian, Japan and Ghosts. And that brings us to a close on the podcast this week. It has flown by in the same way that a chicken doesn't. If you'd like to hear this podcast again, I will happily phone you up at 11:30 at night and play it down the phone. But otherwise, access it through the usual means. If you listen to it off the site or off iTunes, you can also find all the podcasts over at Parish Council, and that's council.co.uk, but you can always find it in the place that you found it now. Thank you, Terence. We'll see you next time, and you at home, thank you. We'll see you next time as well. Bye-bye.
Once upon a time when we were friends, I gave you my heart, the story ends. No happy ever after, now we're friends. Wish upon a star if that might help.
The stars collide if you decide.
Wish upon a star if that might help.
daylight almost gone. It seems there's something that you know. Well, I ought to leave. The rain, it never stops, and I've no particular place.
Dacom Shore Media Production.